Welcome to this lecture this evening. I'd like to tell you a few things about what's going on here at Pacifica, and then I'll introduce our speaker, and we're in for a treat this evening. The first thing is what you'll hear will be a specific lecture on the human soul, but Arel, as you're going to hear, is involved in many projects, and one of the things he most recently did was be involved with the Jung-Neumann correspondence, which was just published in April, and he held a conference in Israel on that. And Pacifica is going to hold a related event next June, June 22nd and 24th. If you get one of these, hopefully they're at... Are they out there, Heidi? Yeah. Okay, so if you get one of these, you can find down here on the bottom of the first page, June 24 to 25, C.G. Jung and Eric Neumann, A Creative Relationship. And it's going to be a symposium here on at Pacific on that. It's, the first time outside of Israel that this will happen. So it's a premier event. We're excited about that. For those of you who want to know more about Pacific, I'll just mention there's also one of these that you can pick up. It's about an introduction open house that we'll have this coming weekend on Saturday, so anyone who's interested in that. All right, what I'd like to do now is turn to introduce our speaker, a friend, Arel Shalit. I've known for many years in the IAP. While I was president, he was on the ethics committee associated with the organization, so we would meet each other in various spots around the world and got to know each other and develop a friendship. So this is a personal pleasure for me to be able to introduce him. Let me tell you just a little bit about him. Dr. Arel Shalit is a Jungian psychoanalyst in Tel Aviv. He's the past president of the Israeli Society of Analytical Psychology and founding director of the Jungian Analytical Psychotherapy Program in Bar-Ilan University, and past director of the Shammai Davidson Community Mental Health Clinic at the Shalvata Psychiatric Center in Israel. So he's very active as a clinician, as an academic, as a Jungian analyst and scholar, historian. He has various books. You can find them in the bookstore. There's a very nice display there. Among them are The Cycles of Life, Themes and Tales of the Journey of the Journey, Enemy, Cripple, and Beggar, Shadows in the Hero's Path, The Complex Path of Transformation from Archetype to Ego, The Hero and His Shadow, Psychopolitical Aspects of Myth and Reality. He also writes a lot on politics, and we may hear a bit of that this evening. And he has a novella, Requiem, A Tale of Exile and Return. And together with Nancy Ferlotti, he's edited A Dream and Its Amplification. And he's also the editor, as we were just talking about this evening, of Jacob and Esau, on the collective symbolism of the brother motif. And this is an previously unpublished manuscript of Eric Neumann's. It's very exciting in the scholarly world to have something new come out that we've not seen before. And so hopefully we'll hear at least some echoes of that. He's also working on another text, I understand. There's some very exciting things that are being discovered in archives. And he's... let's see, the Turbulent Times, Creative Minds, Eric Neumann and C.G. Jung in Relationship, that was co-edited with Murray Stein, as well as the forthcoming book on the human soul in transition at the dawn of the new era. That's our talk for this evening. And with that, I'll ask you to welcome Dr. Shalit.
Thank you, Joe, for introducing me. Thank you, Heidi, for arranging this event. It's an honor and a pleasure to be at Pacifica. In my view, Pacifica is one of the leading institutions of conveying the tradition of debt psychology in a world that mostly refrains from looking into the depths, and with a, I believe, commitment or obligation to give voice to the perspectives that come from the depths of the psyche. Every era has a certain zeitgeist, a certain spirit of the times, something that is the major characteristic, often at the expense of what lies in the shadows, what is less visible and often seen as less desirable. I think it's the commitment of depth psychology to raise its voice as well in relation to what takes place in at any era in any society, not in order to impair progress and development, but to show those sides that so often are neglected. And I believe that Pacifica again here is one of the voices or one of the possibilities where one can bring forth those ideas that may be instrumental sometimes to compensate what takes place in an unimpeded, unrestricted, unlimited way without looking into the side effects. So I hope that my lecture here tonight will be my small, humble contribution in that area. Ever since I was a child, I was gracelessly bored by and uninterested in those endless, murky, smelly, and suffocating museum exhibits of ancient Bronze and Iron Age tools. Those dusty shelves of broken pottery and long, boring descriptions on bleak and yellow cardboard, they did not evoke my curiosity. I failed to become excited over the, to me, indistinguishable differences between rectilinear or curvilinear patterns of tools from different eras. Thus, years later, Lewis Mumford's 1969 book, The Myth of the Machine, was to me a welcome relief. He writes, "Man's brain was from the beginning far more important than his hands. Ritual and language and social organization, which left no material traces whatsoever, although constantly present in every culture, were probably man's most important artifacts from the earliest stages on. And that so far from conquering nature or reshaping his environment, primitive man's first concern was to utilize his overdeveloped, intensely active nervous system and to give form to a human self, set apart from his original animal self by the fabrication of symbols, the only tools," Mumford writes, "that could be constructed out of the resources provided by his own body, dreams, images, and sounds." Now that made sense to me. Dreams and images rather than tools and stools. Jung says, "Whoever speaks in primordial images speaks with 1,000 voices." And, says Jung, "in each of these images there is a little piece of human psychology and human fate, a remnant of the joys and sorrows that have been repeated countless times in our ancestral history. The images of interiority cannot exist without the soul. In soullessness, in fundamentalism and totalitarianism, there are no images. The existence of the soul, that elusive, purely poetical idea of anima, whether in man or woman, cannot be bound by earthly empires, neither by imperial rules nor by imperatives, but can only be poetically imagined, for instance, as that image of a mirror that mirrors the image. As James Hillman so poetically says, "Though I cannot identify soul with anything else, I also can never grasp it by itself apart from other things, perhaps because it's a reflection in a flowing mirror, or like the moon which mediates only borrowed light." But just this peculiar and paradoxical intervening variable gives one the sense of having or being a soul. However intangible and tangible and indefinable it is, soul carries highest importance in hierarchies of human values, frequently being identified with the principles of life or even of divinity. The idea of the image constitutes the imperceptible nuclear force around which the images of soul and psyche gravitate. But the soul also relies on the capacity of imagelessness in the sense of an absence of externally generated images. In their discussion centered around Neumann's manuscripts on Jacob and Esau, Jung writes that the imagelessness, that is, of the God image, is exceedingly important for the free exercise of intuition that would be prejudiced by a fixed image and thereby would have been rendered unusable. While images take shape within our individual psyche, the image is not only within us, but we are also within the image, as Henri Corbin says. We reside within an image of the world, within the world's soul, and we relate to the world according to the images, ideas, and perspectives that we have developed, and to a large extent, according to the views and the spirit of our times. When listening to the brilliant young men and women at the forefront of progress, those that hold the trigger to the chips and the apps of the future, one cannot refrain from being amazed at the firm belief and complete conviction that technology is the remedy of all ills and the foundation of all future viruses. Virtues, not viruses. This lecture is an attempt to cause a slight crack in the confidence of the young, and perhaps it's merely an old man's pathetic envy of tomorrow's triumphant heroes to whisper in their ears, "You're also mortals." However, to justify myself, I cannot at least I cannot but at least raise a question. When I hear one of these brilliant young men proudly revealing his new invention, an app on your cell that speedily measures all relevant physiological parameters and immediately will tell you your mood, so that you might know, for instance, if you are happy. And I wonder, can I really be happy and feel happy if I need to be informed about it by my cell phone, by a telephone? Doesn't a mood, in fact, mean that it's something that I can sense by myself without having to be fed that piece of data from a telephone? Telephone means sound from afar. Can the sounds and the noises from afar truly replace the voice from within? At what point does the tool stop being a helpful extension of the human hand and brain and become the machine that holds us in its grip by means of seduction, addiction, and our all too human weaknesses? Do 93 million daily selfies replace one single moment of true reflection? And if we stop listening to the voice from within, without soulful reflection, will we remember who we are? Or do we end up as part of an identity-less crowd, the anonymous mass man? Will we forget whom we are as distinct, separate individuals? What will happen to our unique self, and will we lose our anchor in the greater self that connects us with the anima mundi, the soul of the world? Will memory, which is the glue that holds the experience of psyche together, memory which connects the islands of awareness into a unified sense of understanding, will it atrophy? Not only because we hand it over to the hard disk, but Vint Cerf, one of the fathers of the internet, warns us against a digital dark age when all images and documents that have accumulated will be lost as the hard and the software become obsolete. We will then return to a history-less era, or rather to an Alzheimerian age when memory has been deleted. Well, if memory does not betray me, we might say that psychoanalysis began with hysteria, dreams, and memory. Only half a century later did we receive memories, dreams, and reflections. While Pavlov claimed that all types of psychological activity are based on reflexes, I am sad to say that far from all psychological activity is based on reflection. Hysteria was the voice that psychoanalysis, the science of imagination, called for in order to exclaim, to call out loud and clear that there are sexual desires and erotic fantasies, repressed, seemingly forgotten, hiding behind the prude femme, behind the straight-laced appearance of prissy prudishness. The dream, insofar as we don't dismiss yet Papa Freud, served as the secret repository for the wishes yet to be fulfilled. If we remember to find our way through the hidden labyrinth of the latent text. And the screen memory, said Freud, was there to tell us that what we think we remember is not the real thing, which deviously hides behind the deceptive screen of triviality. Also, in Jungian therapy and analysis, we often begin by going back in time, because what lies behind us is our shadow. So we go back in time to remember, to recall, and to recollect. In our search for lost times, à la recherche de temps perdu, we remember, gather those scattered fragments that, if merely left behind in bygone times, leave our souls scarred by repression, their sense of meaning obliterated by denial. And we recall by attending to those voices that echo back at us from within, and that hopefully called us from without to come home for dinner, and that reverberate to us from our ancestral past. And if we are sensitive enough, we hear the voices that call upon us from within the womb of the future. And we recollect by bringing ourselves back home, or by bringing ourselves back home to the self. The act of self-recollection, says Jung, the gathering together of what is scattered, he contends, indicates the integration and the humanization of the self. So when Carl Gustav Jung Jr., the younger, comes along, walking those unfamiliar stairs in the dream of his now familiar multi-storied house, descending to the cave cut in the rock, digging out the scattered bones and broken pottery, the very old human skulls call upon him from under the dust. Then I awoke, writes Jung. That is, those half-disintegrating old skulls at the bottom of his dream wake him up, made him aware that archetype is memory. Memories that extend beyond the personal experience of one's individual life, reminding us to stir up the ancestors from the dust, to let them clear their rusty voices so that we can hear their ancient stories of hidden treasures, and so that the ghosts that otherwise lose their shape in the mud can regain their contour in the complex dress. Incidentally, talking about dust, when my son-in-law asked my then 2.5-year-old grandson what I do for a living, he said, "Grandfather hides dust." I will leave it up to you to decide how to interpret that. But in reference to Jung, may it be that when we call out for the soul, as he does in the Red Book, upon our return, that we shake the dust of all the lands from our feet. Or that in the dust, the souls hidden in matter shake off their earthly garb and rise to the clouds that bring the moisture of life back to earth. Or may it be that he, Zohar is his name, who at that age loved to move the dust around so that it would rise into the air, uncovering the mystery of matter flowing in ether, believed me to just be an old dust collector, old man as I am, closer to the breath of air that returns to the dust than the child who spirals up from the earth into the spirits of above. There is flavor to memory, just like images flourish in our feeling. There is a smell and a taste to recollection, a sweetness and sentiments that arise when we look at a photo album, recalling the grains between the toes on childhood's sandy shores. For good old Marcel Proust, a spoonful of the tea and the taste of the Madeleine bring him back to the memory of the old grey house up on the street. And in that moment, all the flowers in our garden and in the park, and the water lilies on the Vivonne, and the good folk of the village, and their little dwellings, and the parish church, and the whole of Combray, not Cambrai, Combray, and of its surroundings, taking their proper shapes and growing solid, sprang into being, writes Marcel Proust, town and gardens alike, all from my cup of tea. The taste of the tongue and the songs in our soul and the bodies that tenderly touch each other's hearts may all too hastily be swept away as we sweep the touch screen in a futile attempt to look at the ceaseless stream of digitized photos, no longer identified by name and place and date, but numerated into infinity. The many has replaced the one, and we hardly return to look at a photo again, to pay respect, to spect again, to respect by looking again, perhaps having forgotten that the soul resides in what we respect and revisit, in the sense of looking again, in the exploration of the experience. Memory is crucial to the human condition. Often have I heard those who returned from hell say that even if you have survived the Shoah, you do not survive Holocaust denial. Memory is essential to meaning. A patient of mine who had emerged from years of hellish suffering needed to tell and hear and tell the stories of hell in order not to forget her suffering, so that she would remember the sense of life's meaning imprinted in years of pain and struggle. Now, we are told, the new cure for post-trauma is memory deletion, the forgetting pill that erases painful memories forever. At least I think it is forever, if my memory doesn't fail me. No longer shall the memory of the horrors of war and rape, of terror, murder, or abuse haunt the suffering soul. As the author of that unforgettable, truly memorable article says, in the very near future, the act of remembering will become a choice. In parenthesis, it didn't take long until it was revealed that the author of that article inserted faked quotes in his book Imagine, which has since been withdrawn by the publisher, trusting that his readers to have lost enough of their memory not to question his lack of integrity, and perhaps confusing imagination with imitation, one of the great sins of the postmodern era. Were I to suffer severe trauma, perhaps the forgetting pill would be my treatment of choice. I may have rushed into the promising embrace of painless forgetting. And are we not engaged so much in trauma these days because we know there is something out there that is hurting more and more people around the world? And I remain skeptical and concerned whenever I hear the promises of shadowless utopia, perhaps because I have what might be an unjustified, perverted preference for dystopia. There are memories that are unbearable. Memories whose weight is so heavy that we cannot bear it. Memories that humiliatingly force us down on our knees. Yet, artificially erasing them may carry the even heavier weight of the loss of mind and psyche. The Norse god or giant Mimir, the rememberer, tells us that the well of knowledge and wisdom is guarded by memory. Neither does the ease of access in today's world to a wealth of information automatically make us richer in knowledge. Nor does it necessarily bring us closer to the treasures of wisdom. Rather, the dream of full access to human knowledge amounts to a state of ignorance, as Daniel Matiuk says, and we arrive at the poverty that stems, according to Walter Benjamin, from the divorce of experience and tradition. Memory, in fact, is the grand achievement of psychization. Without it, there can be no representation. Representation which is the pillar of civilization. That something is not merely presented, but represented, symbolized. Extracting us from the condition in which we merely do an act without the mental experience of the actual experience. Without recognition and representation, both relying on our capacity to recollect, we live the unreflected life. This is the fanatic and the fundamentalist, who all too easily chops off your head and destroys any trace of past cultures, because there is no process of psychization, of symbolization, and no representation, only concrete literalness where the other who carries the projected evil has to be destroyed. Is it not for memory's sake that the baby spends most of its time in a state of dreaming, just like the old person often spends time recalling and remembering, unless dementia has cruelly stolen the recollection from him or her? Let me repeat that. Is dementia not the cruelest of diseases, stealing one of the pillars and most fond activities of old age, the capacity to remember. In a cycle that archetypally repeats itself daily, life transforms itself on an axis from the infant's unmediated experience to the old person's recall and recollection of remembered experience. Memorylessness is an Alzheimerian attack on the existentialist cycle of the human psyche through life. The baby's dreaming transforms a touch, a pressure, a pain and a pleasure, a sound and a sight into the capacity to experience the touch, the pain and the pleasure, the sound and the sight. The actual experience becomes a psychic experience. Thus, memory and recognition, continuity, constancy and reliability of memory ripen and develop, in contrast to dwelling in a condition of erratic fragments of unrelatedness, as long as and when memory can only be described as unconnected islands in the ocean of the mind. The constant onslaught of stimuli on the city dweller's psyche requires the individual to adapt by disengagement, claims Walter Benjamin, who would have been more than 120 years old by now, having safely crossed the French-Spanish border, but fearing repatriation into Nazi hands by the Franco regime, had he not committed suicide or died some other way, September 1940, at the very center of misfortune, as Hannah Arendt said. Disengagement and alienation impair the capacity to appreciate poetry. In fact, Walter Benjamin considered urbanization to be the internalization of forgetting. And, we may add, an overdose of defenses is suicidal to the soul, causing it to freeze or go into exile, even if there may sometimes be no alternative in the shadow of Holocaust and deceit, of fascism and fragmentation, of racism, totalitarianism and atomization. From the perspective of analytical psychology, Jung and Neumann dealt prominently with the soul and the ethics of modern man and mass-mindedness. Jung writes in a letter in 1947 that collective systems have a destructive effect on human relationships. Totalitarian states, he says, undermine personal relationships through fear and mistrust, the result being an atomized mass in which the human psyche is completely stifled. We may add that quantification, for instance by demographics or statistics, is our way to conceive a recognizable persona of the group in the lack of the qualifying character that we find in the actual face of one and each individual. The atomized mass, however, is not solely a consequence of the totalitarian regime or totalitarian mind. Rather, the unintegrated mass man in our soul lacks integrity, lacks the capacity to hold out against fear and mistrust, and therefore may all too willingly wear the uniform, the one and single uniform or shape, whether of manifest or of latent totalitarianism. Erich Neumann describes how the detachment from the original group and from the unconscious has, on the one hand, degenerated into over-specialization, and on the other hand, exalted the mass as a conglomerate of unrelated individuals. The homogeneous group making up the tribe, clan, or the village has been exchanged for the mass units of city, office, or factory, says Neumann. And now, many years later, the mass units of the city and the factory have been replaced by the mega units of faceless friends on Facebook and the avatars of Second Life. The quantitative limitations of what some of us old dust gatherers insist on calling reality have been broken up by boundaryless virtuality. 25 million people have watched a perhaps cute but absolutely trivial depiction of the birth of a baby avatar on Second Life. Sorry, update, 34 million views. The Grapes of Wrath, The Old Man and the Sea, and Huckleberry Finn still need a lot of anger and wind in the sail and much adventure ahead in order to get anywhere near those 34 million. Erich Neumann says that what we get when consciousness is overpowered and possessed by the unconscious mass component is the mass man as manifested in the mass epidemics of recollectivization. We might deceive ourselves that we have attained historical heights of individual development, but the postmodern condition reflects rather disorientation, fragmentation, superficiality, and atomization. While in general we partake less and less in external reality, we can occasionally witness the process of enantiodromia, when something turns into its own opposite. When we see the young who leave their one-person multi-communication chambers and take to the streets and the city squares. The fact that the spirit of youth rarely ascends to the corridors of power is a political cruelty and an existentialist tragedy. Mass man resides within. Mass mindedness is a state of mind, and the collective shadow is most prominent in the disengaged individual. While the negative element, as Neumann says, essentially has a meaningful place as decomposition and death, as chaos and prima materia, in a fragmented psyche, it becomes a cancer and a nihilistic danger. Neumann notices that it's the cleavage between ego consciousness and the unconscious which enables the regression to the mass man in us. And he points out that the mass is the decay of a more complex unit, not into a more primitive unit, but into a centerless agglomeration. a centerless agglomeration is the antithesis of centroversion, of a centered focal entity, which we may term a or the self. Centerlessness is a characteristic of the postmodern condition, thus perhaps both a consequence of historic regression as well as a catalyst for a process of disengagement, fragmentation, and transiency. The pseudo-unity composed by a herd of atomized individuals, says Neumann, is sheer illusion. Could that illusion of pseudo-unity be more true than today? While Neumann refers to transient mass phenomena, such as mass meetings, the very same holds water in a world where the boundaries between the virtual and the real are blurred, in which the meeting place is a Facebook page, where friends are no longer individuals in relation, but numbered in the hundreds, and like is not a real value and a feeling, but a button and a rating. All of you who have iPhones and iPads, could you push like, please? While we desire transparency in management and politics, not only WikiLeaks, the boundaries of privacy are porous, broken through in the dual reality world where practically every event is photographed and posted on the web. Once upon a time, we claimed that an event that was not related to seemingly did not take place, since it's not registered in consciousness if we don't relate to the event. And therefore, when not related to, when an event is not brought into consciousness, it has a tendency to repeat itself compulsively. That's the way complexes work. They repeat themselves compulsively, detracting energy from consciousness rather than being integrated into consciousness. But this view is quickly becoming obsolete, better forgotten. Now, an event has not taken place if it's not registered visually, digitally, and preferably posted on the world wide web of fairies and princes, an artificial world which often keeps us away from the complex reality of the natural world. One of the characteristics of this collective reservoir is the lack of differentiation. The stage of consciousness that has not yet been fully reached by the global psyche of the internet. Gold and garbage mix. And it does require the wisdom of the alchemist to extract the gold from the garbage. Processes that once were thought of as internal, pertaining to reflection and interiority, are now increasingly exteriorized, and we all become addicted to speed and impatience, to quantity and masses, to association and fragmentation. Is it any wonder that we are concerned with attachment and attachment theory in a world which so much lacks attachment? Is it any wonder that post-trauma is on the rise because civilization hurts? Is it any wonder that ADHD is becoming a mass diagnosis because we are becoming increasingly restless. I'm concerned that in an era of recollectivization, the alchemist is a rare species, and the undifferentiated ability to associate, to move between websites and posts, is a much more common trait. The patient and determined persistence of the alchemist in his laboratory is replaced by the uncommitted and impatient movement of what I call the transient personality. The temporary constellation of groups, crowds, and masses, the momentary meeting at the city's crossroads, or the incidental minute of waiting for the metro, has now been elevated into virtuality. And virtuality is no longer confined to its limited space in a little box, in an electronic device that accepts, processes, stores and outputs data at high speeds according to programmed instructions, as the dictionary calls the computer. No, virtuality is now becoming augmented. Augmented reality, and actively changes our ways of seeing reality, of differentiating the internal from the external by intentionally blurring the boundaries between them. And in those olden bygone times, differentiation between the internal and the external, and the capacity of reality testing, were thought of as significant capabilities of the ego. But the definition of ego functions will have to change, and perhaps rely more on sensory coordination than boundaries and differentiation. Once it was important to know and differentiate what's inside and what's outside, between me and the object. Now the important thing is the speed of coordination. Dual or recorded or photographic reality means we will no longer merely live an experience, say, a moment of love, a gentle touch, an erotic scent, or a moment of horror, a harsh blow, or the stench of defeated trenches. No, the experience will be simultaneously recorded. A parallel photographed reality will blur the boundary between experience and its registration. Registration of reality will impinge upon the experience of reality. The psychological, reflected upon, remembered, and explored experience will become obsolete and outnumbered, since everything is already deposited in the exteriorized memory of the hard disk. In her important book on photography, Susan Sontag writes, "Photography implies that we know about the world if we accept it as the camera records it. But," she says, "this is the opposite of understanding, which starts from not accepting the world as it looks." And today, the camera records practically everything. Even when we use Skype, We cannot refrain from seeing ourselves in the midst of interaction. Mirroring and the mirrored life are replaced by the photographed life. Memories, dreams, and reflections are replaced by photos, applications, and blog posts. The former, memories, dreams, and reflections, are necessary for the sense of depth of experience, while too much of the latter ones, photos, applications, and blogs, tends to flatten experience. I apologize for this somewhat lengthy description, but combined with other features of the postmodern condition, this reality change is an enormous leap in humankind's perception of itself and of the world. It does pertain to the sense of transiency that characterizes this era and condition. In the center of which stands the transient personality, constantly on the go, restless and pseudo-present, seductive in his or her appearance, a chameleonic master of changing colors, yet captive in its own adaptability. Without anchor in its own memory and self-recollection, the transient personality eventually gets trapped, crashing into its memorylessness and dismembered fragmentation. Susan Sontag's point is crucial. Information becomes pseudo-knowledge and false understanding when it relies on the recording camera rather than being anchored in the self, the archetype of meaning. Her statement back in 1973, more than 40 years ago, that having an experience becomes identical with taking a photograph of it and participating in a public event comes more and more to be equivalent to looking at it in photographed form, sounds prophetic. It is, in fact, the very opposite of psychization, of the process of psychization, which is decisive in the development of human consciousness, when the actual experience is elevated into the psychic experience, the experience in the psyche. I would dare to say that the transient personality is characterized by identification with photographed and photographing reality. The transient personality is present in a way similar to the camera, not really and meaningfully present, yet present with the accuracy of the camera. The transient personality, in its full-blown manifestation, does not live an authentic life, grounded in one's inner core, in one's inner center, in one's inner secret. Secret is Latin. It comes from secretaris. To set apart, something internal that's set apart, that's not out there visible all the time. In that sense, secret has the very same meaning as the Hebrew word for holy, kadosh, which also means set apart. The transient personality in its full-blown manifestation does not live an authentic life. A life grounded in one's inner core, attending to one's inner voice of meaning, wisdom, self, and vocation. Rather, the transient personality lives a camera reality, as if part of a film. Life is a film to him. There may be many constructive uses of the camera, both in private as well as collective documentation, in arts and entertainment. But it's quite different when a person lives reality by means of the camera. Yanir, let's call him Yanir, for instance, had a great difficulty in feeling his own presence across situations. There was no real constancy in his identity and in his own sense of identity across situations. Constantly, he was on the move, living in a sense of depersonalization and derealization, both with his wife and children and with people at work. He chose to be a prison guard, perhaps guarding himself from running off into excessive associativeness, into hyperactive reality, not remaining anchored anywhere, particularly not in his own feelings or in an inner sense of meaning. He asked his therapist to video record the sessions so that after his death they could be given to his children. Didn't Shakespeare say that life is like acting on a stage? Was his take on the British author. And he said, "My best appearance is in therapy with you," he told his astonished therapist, who wasn't sure if he was joking with her or if he was serious. I am not sure that he knew himself if he was joking or if he was serious. I believe that Umberto Eco speaks of the transient personality when he says, "The completely real becomes the completely fake." Compare this with a comment by Leslie in the film Birdman, when she tells Mike, "Maybe here, up here, that is, on stage, you are Mr. Truth, Mike. But in the real world, where it counts, you're a fraud." However, the big problem is not the individual case, but the collective culture. Freud spoke of screen memory, a memory that serves as a smokescreen, repressing the recollection of an emotionally more significant memory. Today, the screen prevents us from the unmediated experience of reality. Some time ago, on a flight from Los Angeles to Denver, I made a little research. Since I am somewhat of a shy researcher, I didn't want to draw too much attention or intimidate my research subjects. So my figures may not be completely exact, but they are not far from empirical truth. Before the seatbelt sign was turned on prior to landing, I walked the length of the plane back and forth. I counted, and we were about 120 adult passengers. In addition to 120 adult passengers, there were somewhere between 80 and 100 pods and pads and other devices. There were 6 books, and to my great surprise, there was one man looking out of the window, taking in the beauty of the Rocky Mountains, I could not help but look out as well, and both of us just smiled at each other in that moment of sharing the sight of nature's beauty. While depression, anhedonia, anxiety, hypermnesia, guilt, and grief are some characteristics of the survivor syndrome, as originally formulated by William Nederland, the modern-day transient personality has a great, in contrast to all that, the transient personality has a great capacity for change and speedy adjustment to novel situations, often lacking depth and constancy of feeling, such as genuine love and true friendship, or pain and sadness. He is restlessly moving on, fleeing the angst. The transient personality searches for uncommitted freedom, yet at the same time seeks ever-elusive closeness, often through internet dating networks and babble chats. He or she is less capable of considering the consequences of his or her acts because a machine-like quality has become an integral aspect of interpersonal relations. It is as if life is a grand simulator. Yet the transient personality has an increased need for instant gratification, including his or her inducing his or her acts with narcissistic importance, because words are not spoken discreetly in dialogue and relationship with another person, nor with a community of people whose faces with which one is familiar. But the transient personality communicates with the impersonal, unnamed mass of anonymous and pseudonymous by means of the machinery in cyberspace. The boundary between the human individual and a spam-generating machine is becoming blurred. The transient personality rarely turns up for therapy because he or she does not stay in one place. Constantly on the go, the transient personality is actually stuck in his or her own impermanence, avoiding the soulful quest of the true wanderer. If he does arrive at the door of our clinic, we soon discover that he is simultaneously shopping for other therapists at the same time. And if he remains for a while, he has a reflexive, yet unreflective, compulsive need to answer the mobile phone, which just cannot be turned off, only to say, "Honey, I'm in treatment," to whatever familiar or unfamiliar honey that happened to be calling. It is as if the cell phone serves as a sublimated umbilical cord attached to whatever virtual breast whose presence at the other end of the electromagnetic field is necessary to confirm one's mere existence. The transient personality is never fully present because he or she is not really touched, and in any case, he soon moves on. Even in seemingly personal relations, the object, the other, the real person is not seen. Affect becomes flat, superficial, or merely faked. One of the reasons for this is the need to avoid pain. And virtuality can retain the illusion of the painless life, while reality sometimes hits us hard. The reality, for instance, of feeling imposes pain and suffering, as well as providing an opportunity for true love. The uniqueness of the objects is exchanged for the replicability that comes from turning the person into an object. There is no sense of loyalty in the transient personality, neither to people, nor to places or ideas. The transient personality travels concretely and psychologically with a passport for every purpose. Everything seems to lie bare in front of the transient personality, just like everything is revealed in front of our eyes by unlimited access and disclosure on the screen. Nature, which loves to hide, to quote Heraclitus, is stripped bare. When everything is brought into light, nakedly exposed, we become blind for what lies behind, underneath. Only what lies hidden can be seen in full. Ever since my own body's eyes through my own hands took away the world of appearance, says Oedipus, I think I have actually begun to see. And this world, he says, which is incomprehensible to our senses, is the only true world which I now know. All else is simply an illusion which deludes us and confuses our contemplation of the divine, says Oedipus. In the recollectivized world and psyche, the ego becomes associatively adaptive. Engulfed by memoryless transiency, driven by the need of instant gratification and impatient, restless movement, because the ego is not anchored in an archetypal sense of meaning, anchored in the archetype of meaning, the self. Meaning requires location, first of all, an inner sense of location. But in the outer world, we are becoming increasingly dislocated, since the exterior is increasingly becoming replicated. The non-locality and temporality of airports as temples of transiency soothes the restlessness of the transient personality and suits him much better than the terminus of the therapy room and the analytic relationship, which is with its hermetically sealed boundaries. Duty-free implies to be free of duty, freedom from commitment, loyalty, and obligation. Outsourcing, by the way, as an expression of globalization, is sometimes quite a good idea. But sometimes it can be a manifestation of dislocation in a more profound sense. Take, for instance, the editing of the Encyclopedia of Psychology and Religion, in which I have a few entries. One of my references was, quite naturally, I believe, in an Encyclopedia of Psychology and Religion, to the Bible. So the outsourced copy editor of the Encyclopedia of Psychology and Religion requested me to fill in who the author of that book is. Well, I tried to explain to him that that question has not been fully resolved yet, but he did not think that was funny. And he demanded that I fill in the exact name of the author of the Bible. I considered telling him it was John Huston. This condition of non-locality, of non-places, as described by French philosopher Marc Auger, is reflected as well by the highways that bypass the towns and the villages with only signs of the existence of historical monuments. The identity of a place has been replaced by global replications, whether McDonald's, Marriott, or IKEA. Before I finish, allow me to read a piece from Italo Calvino, who describes this condition so well when he tells us about the city of Trude. If, he writes, on arriving at Trude, I had not read the city's name written in big letters, I would have thought I was landing at the same airport from which I had taken off. The suburbs they drove me through were no different from the others, with the same little greenish and yellow houses. Following the same signs, we swung around the same flower beds in the same squares. The downtown streets displayed goods, packages, signs that had not changed at all. This was the first time I had come to Trude, but I already knew the hotel, Marriott, where I happened to be lodged. I had already heard and spoken my dialogues with the buyers and sellers of hardware. I had ended other days identically, looking through the same goblets at the same swaying navels. Why come to Trude? I asked myself, and I already wanted to leave. You can resume your flight whenever you like, they said to me, but you will arrive at another Trude, absolutely the same, detail by detail. The world is covered by a sole Trude, which does not begin and does not end. Only the name of the airport changes. It is by self-recollection, as Jung says, by gathering together what has been scattered, that we become human. Insofar as life moves along an axis from experience to internalization, consciousness, and recollection of the experienced life, which also in itself is a continually repeated cycle day and night. The old person of whatever chronological age integrates his or her life by self-recollection, while the transient personality who thrives so seemingly well in our fragmented postmodern condition that he or she hardly the old person of whatever chronological age integrates his or her life by self-recollection, while the transient personality integrates his or, sorry, while the transient personality who thrives so seemingly well in our fragmented postmodern condition will remain bleeding by the scars of those scattered fragments that he or she hardly felt when stepping on them. Just like the post-traumatic sufferer who is haunted by the sometimes unintegratable horrors that shattered the world and his or her psyche. The problem with the transient personality is that he or she has adapted all too well to a post-traumatic world, itself dissociated from the world of reality. Insofar as self-recollection pertains to integration and humanization, as Jung has it, this is what constitutes the capacity to hold up against recollectivization, where we lose our individuality, so not to be swept away by the seductive forces of the collective. By recollecting the voice of the ancestors, calling upon us from underneath those layers of dust, and by listening to the call of the future which always is a constantly newborn child, we can perhaps remain relatively integrated individuals, even in the transiency of the present. Thank you.
Thank you, Arel, for that marvelous extended reverie on image, memory, animation, and all of its shadowy elements. It seems particularly interesting and relevant that there was such a set of reflections around the digital world here, as many of the students who are here in the audience are in a hybrid program that is partly online and partly residential. And they move between the worlds that you're talking about. So with that, what I'd like to do is open it up for a little bit of question from the audience. And would you please come up to the microphone, because we're taping this. We're doing an audio tape. So please find your way here, and if you can, give your name. Thanks.
There's no need to pose it as a question. You can be free to make any comment. Please. And since I happen to know you, Serena, and I am a poor foreigner, so please just speak slowly and clearly.
He knows me so well. It's scary. Hi, Rel. I wanted to ask, you mentioned something, I'll be sure I got it right, the transient personality, meaning all the avid, you know, techies that we've all become, is it avoiding depression? Is that what you were saying, in a way? Avoiding feeling?
Okay, I think that's a great question. I don't think that all technology freaks, etc., and I don't really have, I'm no Luddite. I have nothing really against technology and development, etc. I just want to emphasize some of the shadow sides. The transient personality, yes, who is not necessarily someone who works with computers, but it's a personality that I am sure that we all have seen, and we see it more and more. I don't know if you're familiar with Jerome Bernstein's borderland personality, the kind of personality who exits urban society, who communicates better with animals, who stays away quite a lot from the modern world, who is often seen as pretty crazy by most people, but searches him or herself back to nature and more simple living. I think that's an important compensatory element. I think we find it insofar as Freud told us that the abnormal, in fact, limelights the normal. So the borderline personality, who may be somewhat extreme, limelights something that I think is characteristic of many of us. Organic food, like a reaction to being overly genetically modified and maybe poisoned in different ways. So the transient personality is, in a way, the opposite of the borderline personality. The transient personality has adapted to the postmodern world. Postmodern world where, which I believe to a great extent is a reaction to the suffering of the modern world, to the two world wars, and much that came in their vein. And so it's a way, the transient personality, by a variety of means, by faking it, by not being touched, by creating an illusion often of nearness. Just to share with you one brief detail from one case, a lovely young woman who I saw in therapy. She had, on a flight from New York back home to Tel Aviv, she met this wonderful guy. And if not the same day that they stepped off the flight, so the following day, she, enchanted by him, he promising everything, he moved in with her. And they had a great time, she felt, for an entire month. And she may have been somewhat innocent, completely seduced by him, only to discover that after about 1 month, he had left her, and he had moved in with a next-door neighbor, whom he had met, of course, while living with her. And when she got quite a fit, he could not understand why. Doesn't mean anything. Okay, so he said he was going to marry her. That was then. There is no continuity, no constancy, no object constancy. It is, as I see it, a way of avoiding pain, avoiding suffering. It's just the opposite to the survivor's syndrome. There, it's an avoidance of anhedonia. And we are all, I believe, to some extent affected by it. Whenever I go to a dentist, there is no longer a question about anesthesia. It's automatic. There's no question if I'm able to suffer a bit of pain. So I believe it is part of avoiding pain, avoiding depth, avoiding depression, And I don't think that there are any firm impressions without a bit of depression. So everything becomes superficialized. Please. Were you going to? No? Okay. So.
Good evening. My name is David Nimmer. I heard a word that you must have used a dozen times, but I've never heard it before, and it's a fascinating word, recollectivization. On the one hand, collectivization is emblematic of transient man and the various images that you put up of faceless groups. On the other hand, it's beginning recollect, a word you also used many times, is emblematic of memory, which brings us to the depth field. You did a midrash, if you will, on the word respect. You took the inspection part and intensified it. I wonder about this interesting portmanteau word that you use that moves us in both directions.
Thank you. Without bringing it fully to the surface, I did contrast recollection with recollectivization. So you picked up on that, and I just kind of wandered across it. And I tied recollection to what Jung says about recollection as a way of finding our self. Recollectivization is a term that Erich Neumann used. He didn't use it very often, but he used it as in a where he describes the development of consciousness from the primal state where the individual is not separate from the collective. An original state of individuality as part of the collective in the tribe, etc. From which an individual consciousness develops. But, he says, with an overdeveloped individual consciousness, there is it becomes one-sided. It may well become one-sided. He goes on later to speak about the integration of the feminine. But where the where consciousness becomes one-sided and part of temporary collective units, like, and he speaks about the factory, we could speak about meeting places that are temporary, and we can bring it, which I tried to do, into the digital era, where we suddenly meet on bubble chats or various forums, etc., where there is a loss of individuality. And on the internet, where people use pseudonyms, appear anonymously, jump from site to site, going associatively according to code words, where the anchor within the recollected self is lost, and we just associatively move on, which means that we lose consciousness and in that sense become recollectivized. Please. Yes, please. 1, 2, 3.
Well, first of all, thank you, Errol, for that, what I thought was a brilliant critique of the postmodern world. I'm left wondering, however, whether you feel there's a more positive dimension to the postmodern condition. And I wondered whether you felt that it served to deconstruct the old ego and to kind of permit, therefore, the emergence of a new self, perhaps ultimately on the other side of the problematic aspects of this transition. So that's my question.
Thanks for that question. I'm not. I'm concerned, but Aristoteles said that if development will proceed among the young the way it does, then in 200 years the world will go under. So if Aristoteles was wrong, I am most definitely wrong. I do think that there are changes. I think the great danger is if we leave everything in the hands of those who so speedily construct the instruments that we use for progress. I think we do need balancing powers. I believe that many of the young who study depth psychology in any variety are able to induce something compensatorily there. I do believe, as I've witnessed, I do quite a lot of community dreaming groups, and I've been fortunate to hear dreams that do pertain to our era, where I can hear and see, and people have shared images that do show the possibility of new complexities, of new combinations that don't just turn away from where the world is going, but where also where the world is going in its technological progress, etc., can be conducive as an integrated part, as a part in an integrated whole. And I do think that dreaming itself as a royal manifestation of the psyche brings up new material that can help guide us along. I also do think that I remember a lecture by one prominent computer developer. He was asked a question if he sees any ethical problems. And he didn't seem to consider that for very long and said, no, there are no ethical problems. I'm not sure that the person who does the thing him or herself is the one to be the ethical judge about it. I do think that there is a place for a community of elders, a council of elders. I think that engagement in this world in a variety of forms, not just to resist how the world is developing, because even if anyone would think that it's desirable, it's impossible. But I think there is a lot to contribute by looking at the world, by enlarging the perspectives, by providing more and further perspectives that so easily otherwise get lost. Please.
If I get this a little incorrectly, but from my understanding, you were talking about memory and recollection and how that kind of juxtaposes with fundamentalism and that action without recollection. And perhaps if you could speak a little more to that, and as far as do you find or do you think there's any correlation between the transient type with the fundamentalism that seems to be prevalent?
Okay, thank you. I see the transient personality as a manifestation of the postmodern era. The postmodern era is not fundamentalist. The postmodern era exchanges one truth for anything goes. There is not a single narrative. There is a multitude of narratives. The fundamentalist stands at the very opposite. The fundamentalist suffers from something else, in my view, from archetypal identification. Let me say a word about that. We may have different belief systems. We may adhere to different thoughts. That is not the issue with the fundamentalist. The fundamentalist, first of all, symbolization has collapsed. It's literal. There is no representation. Representation is when we see a Shakespearean play and the head is cut off, but not in reality. There it's a representation of decapitation. It has a certain meaning. The act is not committed. That is in presentation. That is when there is no symbolization. That's when it's literal. And when in archetypal identification, when I don't only adhere to a certain belief system, but I am one with it, then there can be nothing else. Even if I am identified with the absolute good, and I therefore, as if split off the shadow, because in archetypal identification it's one-sided, and I split off the shadow, and I hereby want to tell all of you that I believe in the one and single good. And if you don't, then I better get rid of you. That's the fundamentalist. The fundamentalist does not carry a shadow. The fundamentalist does also not carry an image of the other. The fundamentalist only carries a projection onto the other of the not good, of the evil. And if the other carries the evil and I identify with the good of whatever kind, can be a Nazi good, or if then I am entitled, I am obliged to get rid of that other who brings evil into this world. The problem of every fundamentalist is, however, that if he succeeds, he destroys himself. Often, fundamentalists manage to destroy too much until that happens. But that's the inevitable result of fundamentalism. I could expand more, but I won't do it in this context. I think that's... Okay, no. Yes, please.
And thank you so much for this talk, because I think of these things all the time when I find myself attached to my iPhone, and since I've lost it, I've reduced in anxiety dramatically and gotten a lot more in touch with myself. So it's been just quite an interesting thing to lose my iPhone. But I found it really interesting, your talks on suffering and pain and the value of those experiences to the soul, particularly because I am a mother and I have given birth. And I remember when my doctor asked me if I wanted an epidural. And I remember being in more pain than I could that I had ever experienced in my life. And I didn't really understand what the cost-benefit was. And so I asked him, and his explanation was, well, and we were in New York at the time, do you want to drive to California, fly to California, or walk to California? Either way, you're going to get to California. And, you know, I think of the debates around epidurals, for example, that while you experience a painless birth, the sacrifice is that that those substances may shut down the body's capacity to produce oxytocin, which is essential for the bonding between mother and child. And so that comes to me as an example of what you're talking about. And you remind me of this quote by Khalil Gibran, that pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses our understanding. So thank you.
Thank you very much for both those significant comments. I'm, of course, not going to get involved in childbirth. I have worked with that in the distant past, trying to ease by non-medical means. But I find your comment and your information about it as well very valuable. As well as your additional comments. Thank you. I think we are supposed to end by now, so I just want to thank you for spending the evening with me. Thank you.